I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour of the program, you're probably aware of this, but maybe are not aware of how what the extent of this problem is. There are hundreds of top posts in the administration that have not been filled. And according to a recent article in the Washington Post, the vacancies are hobbling efforts to oversee agency operations and to promote the president's agenda. We're going to be talking about what posts are not filled and how you find people to serve in government and what the holdup is on getting people to serve in many, many different agencies. We have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Lisa Rhine is here. Lisa is a reporter at the Washington Post, where she covers the federal workforce and issues related to the management of government, including the Trump transition. And we also have with us, for at least half of the show, Max Steyer, who is the founding president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, which runs the Nonpartisan Center for Presidential Transition. And that organization helps new administrations be prepared to govern. Lisa, hello. Thanks very much.
We are just working on it now.
Hi. Are you there, Lisa? Hello, Lisa. Lisa, are you there? I don't know where Lisa is, but we should have Max with us. Max, are you there?
I am here, and I'm pleased to be here.
Thanks, Max. We're pleased to have you. And whoops, I just dropped my headphones. We're heading off to a rocky start here.
It happens.
Right. It happens sometimes.
Yes.
It's not even Monday. Let's try Lisa again. Are you there, Lisa? Well, she's not there, so let's try to get her on the phone if we can do that so we can be sure and talk to her. Lisa will be with us, I'm sure, momentarily. But the number, I'm sure you're familiar with how many vacancies there are, Max. Why are there so many vacancies, and how important is it that those be filled? How is it keeping government from functioning, if you believe it is keeping government from functioning, to have so many vacancies?
Sure. And you stop me if you don't want this, but I think a little bit of context may be helpful.
All right,
All right, so we are a unique country in many respects, and in this one I don't think in a good way, but a new president has over 4,000 political appointments.
Wow.
Yes, crazy. No other democracy has anywhere close to that level of what I would describe as, you know, patronage jobs. I mean, they're literally a vestige of the old system where all these jobs were political jobs and where we didn't have a merit-based civil service. Of those 4,000, nearly 1,100, actually more than 1,100, require Senate confirmation. And those jobs are the core jobs that actually constitute the leadership in the federal agencies themselves. And we actually look to a smaller subset, about 560 of those jobs, that are the ones that run the big parts of government. If you strip out the part-time boards and commissions, you wind up with, as I say, a little over 500 jobs that really lead the agencies. Now, of those, President Trump has only got 29 confirmed, and only 49 beyond those 29 have been formally nominated. And so you're looking at a very small fraction of the jobs that are the top jobs to run the agencies, either filled or where there's somebody who is waiting for the Senate to confirm them. So that's the context. Now I can tell you the why, but I wanted to make sure I set the table.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure. So now the why is that this is actually very hard to do. It is not simply, you know, a matter of picking somebody and saying, you know, you go into that job. You actually have to vet them to make sure that they are going to pass through a very difficult process. They must clear a financial review that's run by the Office of Government Ethics. There'll be an FBI background investigation of all these people, and that can take some serious number of weeks to accomplish, but the FBI will look at their background, where they lived, the jobs they held. They'll go out and interview people in all those places, and it's a pretty extensive process.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to answer a ton of paperwork that includes paperwork that the White House and the government provides, and then the Senate committees that oversee the confirmation process for these individuals also have their own independent set of questions that they ask. And then you have a committee hearing, you have to be voted on in the committee, and then ultimately by the Senate itself.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do this right if you don't start very early and in a very organized way. And the source point for the slowness in many respects is that not enough was done pre-inauguration and in some ways pre-election to be ready on day one, on January 21st, when President Trump took office, to have his people come into place very quickly. And from there, they didn't do enough, even once he was inaugurated. They didn't build the infrastructure needed to actually scale the size of appointments that they actually needed to accomplish. So this is a management challenge, and bluntly, they didn't invest early enough or enough attention to make this happen in real time.
Mm-hmm. And is that because you think they didn't think they were going to win, so they weren't even thinking about this?
I don't think that's the case. First of all, again, if you look at history, you know, all presidents have done this poorly. And that's because the job is overwhelming. It's almost impossible to do it right. And because of what a version of what you said, which is candidates for president are focused on one thing, which is winning. And they don't typically invest enough in thinking about what happens if they actually win. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the movie The Candidate, when, you know, Robert Redford asks, now what? You don't want that to happen. And in order to avoid that, you really need to be, you know, chewing gum and walking at the same time. You need a whole separate operation that's organized to focus on what happens if you win. And they have to be prepared, and the campaign itself has to see them as an ally and not try to rework them and redo them if and when they actually win.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more fundamentally what's at stake here is that the president didn't really understand the nature of the job that he was walking into. I don't believe that his prior experience, given the fact that he hadn't been in government previously, that he didn't understand the size, complexity of the governmental process, I don't think his governance model matched up against the need that he had to fulfill. And I don't think he brought people in around him who had an appreciation of the size and scope of the challenge either.
I see.
And so I think there are a number of factors here, and we haven't gotten yet to your last question, which was, does this matter? And I'm happy to, the answer is yes, but I'm happy to talk further about that if that's useful.
Okay. And I'm wondering if there is a problem with finding people to fill these positions. Is government service still attractive?
Well, there will always be more people who want these jobs than the number of jobs. And there's a gentleman who ran the Presidential Personnel Office for President Bush who said this to me the best way possible. And he said that he ran Presidential Personnel, but what he said is that the president appoints and I disappoint, meaning that for any given job that the president appointed somebody, there were lots of different people that had to be told, no, you're not getting this job. So there will always be plenty of people who want the jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, are the most qualified people interested? And are they willing both to go through the process, and are they the ones that are best equipped? And I think the answer still is that there are lots of very talented people who would like to serve their country in these senior positions, but I don't believe that, again, the infrastructure, the people, the organization, and the decisional process has been put in place to identify them and to get them through this crazy, complicated process at the scale that we need.
Yeah. I think Lisa is with us now. Let's try again. Lisa Ryan, are you there?
Hi, yes,
hi,
I am.
Lisa.
Thanks so much.
Sorry,
hi.
We had a problem here. And she's done great reporting on all of this. Thank you so much for joining us. We were talking about why this is important and how the administration may not have quite been prepared here. You also say in one of the articles that you've written that maybe part of the hang-up is that you've got too many people at the table and everybody has to agree on these appointments. Who all is at the table and they all have to say yes?
Well, I think it depends on how high level the hire is and how potentially controversial the hire is. Mm. But Max and I, you have talked about all these issues, and you know, as he just said, you know, there are many, many reasons, you know, owing to vetting, owing to interest, owing to this 5-year lobbying ban that Trump put in when you leave the White House, you know, that has made this process so challenging for this administration. But So let me sort of compare to what happened in the George W. Bush era, where, as I was told by his former, the people who ran his transition and personnel operation, so, you know, a name would come across the transom from maybe a governor or a senator or somebody in the White House, and you know, the person would be vetted and, you know, their resume would be looked at, and then they would be interviewed by the chief of staff and by, of course, the presidential personnel experts, you know, the sort of headhunters, if you will, for the White House, and then maybe the policy expert in the particular area at the White House. And then Karl Rove, we all remember that famous name from the Bush administration, you know, Bush's loyalist and political operator. So his office would have to approve the person. Then, boom, it goes to the president. But in this case, you have a lot of power centers in the White House of people who often have, you know, very different ideological views and who sometimes have not gotten along. And so what we were told is there's a sort of a weekly hiring meeting where you have Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, who kind of represents the populist wing of the White House, and the Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, who's more of an establishment figure, the White House Counsel, Vice President Pence's Chief of Staff, sometimes Ivanka Trump, and then Jared Kushner, the President's son-in-law, sort of who kind of represents sort of the business side of things, sometimes Gary Cohn, the Director of the National Economic Council. So so all these people have to kind of sign off. And, you know, if, as it was explained to me, if, you know, one person has a strong objection, which certainly doesn't happen in every case, but it has happened, that could stop a nominee, and then you'd have to start all over.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to add to that at all, Max?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, Lisa's entirely right, and that the process is much more difficult than has existed in prior administrations. And I think this comes back again to a, you know, failure to recognize the scale of the job in front of them. There's no way, if you try to run everything through a small, narrow pipe that constitutes the White House or a small group of decision makers in the White House, then it means that things back up. Or if they don't back up, you don't actually get to issues until they become big problems. And the personnel side is a fundamental, and this comes back to your earlier question about the why this matters. And personnel is policy. The government is a very large institution that manages all kinds of important activities, and the White House can't control it directly from that one building. They need to have capable leaders in place across the board in order to be able to run in parallel a lot of different activities. Hmm. Getting their people in place is job number one to making that happen.
Right.
It is important to note that there are people in these jobs today. They're acting. And if I might say, you know, many of them, if not all of them, you know, might have actually better subject matter knowledge than whoever the Trump nominee will ultimately be. But they're in an acting role. And my metaphor for this is it's the equivalent of a substitute teacher. You know, a substitute teacher might be an incredible educator, but the fact that they're there to teach that day or that week means that they're not perceived as having real authority. They don't take on the long-term challenges because
right.
they know that they're a gap filler. And that's what we have today. We have exceptional people in the top leadership positions that are hamstrung by the very nature of the way that they're in their jobs, that they're acting, that they're not confirmed by the Senate and picked by the president.
Mm. Well, I'm wondering when you can sort of go on your own. You talk about Elaine Chao hiring somebody to help identify candidates to staff her office. So she just found an agency to do that. Can she then just go on? Does she have authority, Lisa, to hire her own staff?
Well, no. See, that's the problem. So she hired this guy who's is a personnel expert who worked with her when she was the head of the Labor Department during the Bush administration. But the idea is that he's supposed to be helping her identify candidates, but then the White House really needs to make its decision on whether it thinks those candidates are viable. And as it was explained to me, and Max, certainly I'd be helpful for him to weigh in too, but is that, you know, there is a push and pull in every White House between the cabinet secretaries who want their own people, and usually when it comes to a chief of staff, I think mm-hmm. they tend to get their own chiefs of staff. But then the other jobs, even if they're not required to be confirmed by the Senate, even if they're just one or two rungs below that, they still have the White House's involvement because the White House might owe favors to people. The White House also doesn't want the cabinet secretaries to go, you know, sort of too much off message. If you allow them to choose their entire staffs, you know, on their own, you know, you have less control. And as it was explained to me, I mean, of course, it really varies at each agency. The relationship between the president and the cabinet secretary is a factor here in how much independence the secretary is afforded. But this has been unusually, a process that's been unusually strongly led by the White House.
Mm-hmm. I'm also wondering how unusual this is. You talk about the Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who had an undersecretary for policy that he wanted. You would think that he would be able to choose that. The White House had told him it wouldn't fight this, except that they did fight it, and that was in violation of sort of an agreement that Mattis had with the Trump administration to be able to pick his own team.
Right, so it's kind of complicated, right? So Mattis has shared with many people that Trump said you're going to be able to choose your own team, but in the end, that wasn't entirely true. But this nominee Ann Patterson is a very qualified defense official. But the issue, as I understand, with her was it wasn't as much from the White House that the opposition came, but from Republican senators on Capitol Hill who objected to her role during the Obama administration in the Egypt, the question of Egypt's leadership, and that she was viewed as having negotiated with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an organization that the Trump folks are suspicious of. And so I think that the White House, you know, had gotten pushback from some Republicans on the Hill and said, I don't think we want to fight this battle. Mm-hmm. You know, so each high-level person has their own sort of, you know, politics that they bring and political baggage and political experience. And but especially in this White House where they're very, you know, sort of suspicious of people who have had more traditional government experience.
Mm-hmm. So what might be, and let's go to you on this because you're not with us for the full hour, Max, what's a better way to do all of this? What's a way to get some people in these positions so everybody's not overworked and government isn't functioning fully?
It's a great question. And I think you start from where I started at the very beginning, which is you simply reduce the number of political appointments that a president has to make and reduce the number that have to go through Senate confirmation. Mm. The whole point here is you want a president to be able to come in and lead the government, set the policy for this large organization, and have people in place that are going to carry that policy throughout the agencies. You don't need 4,000 people to accomplish that. And as I said earlier, no other democracy has remotely as close to the kind of political penetration as we do in this country. And it's a stumbling block for every administration. This administration just has stumbled harder. And so that's something that could be changed by Congress. These are not, set in the Constitution, and we ought to have many, many fewer of them. And there are kind of two types. There are those that are in these top leadership positions that have line authority over the organizations. And then there are the folks that I would describe as the entourage. And they are the special assistants, the special counsel, the senior counsels, this group of people that serve to support the senior political people. But what they ultimately do is they gum up the system. They cause confusion in the organization because people don't know who is the real decision maker, and they have an intermediary to get through rather than their normal boss through their boss in the normal hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could strip out a lot of these positions, make government more efficient, and that would be a great starting point. Beyond that, with what we have today, there are really three things that have to occur to make this process work right. Number one, and this comes back to what Lisa described earlier, is you need a very clean, fast, decisional process in the White House to determine whether or not people who are selected for these jobs or proposed for these jobs are the people that the White House wants.
Right.
And it can't be a group of six people meeting once a week.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work. Number two, you need an apparatus in the government that's actually fully staffed out with the right people to identify the best talent for these jobs. And that there's an office called the Office of Presidential Personnel. We actually did a white paper on how this needs to be staffed out. And it needs to be more robust than exists today, what exists today. And it also, bluntly, ought to be filled with people who know how to do this. There's a whole industry around executive search that private companies use, and they're talented people who know how to conduct these kinds of activities effectively.
So you're saying,
you want those people.
So you're saying also that office that is supposed to be looking for good staff is understaffed, so they can't look for good staff.
That's correct, and I think it's understaffed. And, you know, it's interesting that it's the rare administration that finds the private sector analog and uses that talent. And so, you know, I'll give you an example here, which is we just had a, you know, worldwide cyber incident, and we need to have the very best chief information officer talent in the federal government, both to protect the government but also to set the right policy for our entire country. Mm-hmm. And many of those jobs are vacant. You ought to have the top search firm people who do CIO searches, so the people from Korn Ferry and Heidrick & Struggles, who specialize in identifying the best technology talent for the very best companies in our country. They could find the very best talent for the U.S. government, too. And my bet is that that very best talent would rather work serving the American public than any other job possible, certainly for, you know, a relatively short period of time. Those are the kinds of people who ought to be selected for the jobs, and that's the right sort of professional who should be looking for them.
What do you think about... Oh, I'm sorry. Number three. Go ahead.
Yeah, number three. Sorry, I'm on a roll here.
It's all right.
Finish off. But you need a clean decisional process. You need the apparatus inside the White House to identify the right talent. And this is coming back to another point that Lisa made. You need clarity between the agencies and the White House about who gets to decide and what that process is going to look like. And this is, again, all about organizational behavior. You need to have clarity in an environment in which you got a lot to do and you have, a fast-moving environment. And right now, you don't really have enough clarity. Mm-hmm. So you do those three things, even in the world we live in today, and you would see, I think, a dramatically different set of at least numbers on the leadership side. Mm.
Lisa, you agree?
Hmm. Yeah, I do. You know, well, first of all, so I did a profile recently of the man who is the head of presidential personnel, who's like, you know, for your listeners, the headhunter for the White House. And he's in charge of this operation. His name is Johnny DiStefano. And I asked him about this question of, well, you have no experience with as a headhunter. And he said, you know, I don't think that I need that experience. And what he described the job as is as a political job, small p, meaning that, yeah, I mean, in the way this, as we've spoken, you know, it's set up in this White House, you're dealing with many stakeholders, many equities, you know, many people with a stake in who gets chosen for the jobs. And so his job, as he put it, was to kind of manage all of those different factions. And to that degree, I mean, if you take as a baseline, okay, this is the way this White House is choosing to carry out this process of hiring to staff up the government, I think he really was right. So I don't know. It's a combination of skills, because the other tricky thing is, despite what Max is saying about, of course you need experts in the field, but it's a balance, because political appointments, by their very definition, are, you know, go to people who are not always pure experts in the field, right? They worked on the campaign, et cetera.
Right, right.
You would hope that they do have some expertise, but not always.
Yeah. And at this point, Max, I know you have to go. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having this conversation. You're in good hands with Lisa.
I know we are. We're in good hands with you too, Max.
All right, you take care.
Thanks, you too. Max Steyer, founding president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. They run the Nonpartisan Center for Presidential Transition, which helps to get new administrations up and running, fully staffed and able to govern. Lisa is a reporter at the Washington Post, and she covers the federal workforce issues related to the management of government and has written extensively about all the positions that are not filled. We'll have to talk about the FBI position, too, because now that's open. What kind of process will be people be going through to fill that? Is that an immediate need? And more in the Justice Department, Lisa has written that Jeff Sessions has openings for all 93 U.S. attorneys. That's a lot. Doesn't it seem like a lot? We'll talk about why that's the case. And what do you think about all of this? I'm sorry I haven't invited you, but we had so much going on that I didn't have a chance. So let me invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, join the conversation there. Keep it going after we're off the air. We'd like to read your comments. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Lisa Ryan is with us now at the Washington Post, and if you want to join us, we'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is our number. I don't know if this is still the case, but this is a case in point of how we're functioning with a pretty slim government here. Jeff Sessions, you write, has openings for all 93 U.S. attorneys.
Right. So U.S. attorneys are political appointees. Technically he does have the right to let them go, which he did a few months ago, and there are 90-some-odd U.S. attorneys who are now in acting roles, filling those jobs. But the thing is that Sessions has been, very much outspoken about his priorities as Attorney General, which include, much stronger offenses for, especially for some drug crimes. He sort of has this whole kind of crackdown on crime he's talked about. I mean, not that all attorney generals talk about this, but, this is a particular issue for him, particularly for drug crimes. And one of my colleagues interviewed him recently at a public event, and she said, well, how can you carry out this this agenda, you want U.S. attorneys to crack down, but you don't have any of your own in place who you have, nominated and put in there. And he said, yeah, we really need to get on that. So
yeah, I
assume that he's frustrated. I don't know. I haven't spoken to him. But, it's true that a lot of the cabinet secretaries in this story we wrote a few weeks ago about the slow nomination process have expressed to colleagues some serious frustration that they don't have their own teams in place. Mm-hmm. And this is really becoming a problem for them because, just as Max was saying earlier in the conversation, they're relying on civil servants in acting roles to carry out, their sort of, political mission. But there's also, this is another theme, there's not a lot of trust really at most agencies between the small cadre of political officials who are in the agencies and the civil servants who are in these acting roles. That causes, that can cause a lot of sort of day-to-day issues.
Well, I'm sure. And you also are looking at substantial changes in many departments. You highlight Education Department, Betsy DeVos, who's leaning heavily, I didn't know this, on the staff of Lamar Alexander, the former Education Secretary. She had hoped to have her own staff in place because there are major changes the administration would like to make to education. So why not get her up to staff so you can implement what you want to do with education? It doesn't make any sense.
Right. So Lamar Alexander is also the key senator who's head of the Senate Education Committee. And under Bush, George W. Bush was Education Secretary. And he's largely responsible for pushing DeVos's nomination through the Senate on a very closely divided vote. So she was a pretty controversial pick for that job. Well, so the reality is that she has submitted, you know, names to the White House of people who she wants to be her deputies. They've apparently gone back and forth, but they haven't been able to agree. There was one case, there's a New Mexico educator named Hannah Scandera who apparently was DeVos's first choice for a top deputy job. And so this woman is a big proponent of the Common Core, which is, you know, this educational testing philosophy, and that is really, you know, opposed by many Republicans. And what happened was, I think the Trump folks were fine with her, but some opponents, conservative Republicans who did not like her views and agree with them, scuttled the nomination, just saying, hey, or maybe she was never nominated officially, but just said, look, we're not going to move on this. So, you know, there's Senate Republicans who have a big role. And I think the other thing just to say is that we've been really talking about the nominations for these jobs at the front end, but there's also the back end, which is getting these nominees through the Senate, mm-hmm. a confirmation process. And so far, only 29 appointees have been confirmed by the Senate. Most of these, I think all but six, are the cabinet secretaries themselves. So we're done with the secretaries, but I think just only a handful of deputies and, you know, heads of smaller agencies like the FDA. Head of the FDA was confirmed fairly recently. And so, you know, the Senate, and there's difference of opinion. So the Senate committee staff will say, oh, well, we haven't gotten the proper paperwork from the White House, so we can't move the nominations forward, you know, through the various, you know, relevant committees. But then the White House says, oh, but we gave all the paperwork over. The Democrats are just blocking the movement on these nominations. So, and, you know, the Senate is growing more partisan every day with the troubles in the White House and all of these revelations about, you know, about Russia, the health care bill. I mean, just so many things going on. And I think that may have a downhill effect on mm-hmm. the pace of these nominees getting confirmed. Mm.
Will that also be true? I'm not sure when we're going to hear a decision on who the FBI director might be, but considering all that's going on and now the president's leaving the country for a while, probably it will enjoy a bit of a breather here because, holy cow, what a couple weeks it has been. But will he very soon nominate somebody for the FBI, and will that also get bogged down?
Well, the president tweeted a number of times in recent days that he expected that process of nominating a replacement for former director James Comey to go very quickly. But it turns out it's getting more complicated. For example, Senator John Cornyn, Republican from Texas, just about an hour ago removed himself from consideration.
Oh, he did. I didn't even hear that.
He was supposed to be. Yeah, he was a leading contender, and it's. So, and he's the second-ranking Republican senator, and he said he'd, you know, rather stay in the Senate. And I think that the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell also, you know, had urged him to stay. In addition, we have yesterday Representative Trey Gowdy, another conservative Republican from South Carolina, took himself out of the running. And then there were reports that, remember Judge Merrick Garland, the
federal judge? Oh, yes, I do.
Who former President Obama had nominated, you know, to be, to replace Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. Well, the Senate Republicans never acted on his nomination. But there were reports floating around that some Republicans, because Merrick is a moderate Democrat, you know, sort of wanted him to consider being FDI director. But he is apparently not interested. So I actually don't know really who is on the short list at this point. I mean, you know, this is a very prestigious job, but it's sort of fraught with political baggage at this point. And mm-hmm. so I just, yeah, there's an acting guy in place. I don't know. Maybe he'll get the job, but I don't. You know, it's sort of rare that a civil servant in an acting capacity like that would be elevated, mm-hmm. you know, to the full to the full director slot.
Let's go to some phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Gary in Fitchburg. Hi, Gary. Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hang on a minute, please.
Oh, not too long, Gary.
Okay, hello, I'm with you.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, it seems that the government we have now, our greatest enemies are not from without, not ISIS, not Russia, but from within. It's like a couple that are stuck living together, and they, at this point, hate each other's guts. I mean, we can't even get infrastructure spending done, and we're still involved in lots of aggressive military operations around the world. We need high-speed trains. We need to bring our troops home. We need to be smart. Quit this fighting. Let's move on and get something done for the people.
Are you worried about all the vacancies that have not been filled, Gary?
Of course. No matter who Trump, I'm normally a very progressive person, but no matter who Trump puts up, it can be, he could put up Jesus and the Democrats would try to block it. This is a non-functioning government, a government at war with itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to stop.
Lisa, your response.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gary, I mean, the thing is, Congress is different from the government. So the government is the executive branch. Those are the federal agencies in, you know, who run the government day to day. And Congress is, you know, the legislative branch, and which has oversight over the White House and over, you know, what the government does. So, yes, I agree that we are in a partisan environment, despite the fact that you do have Republican control of the two houses in Congress and the White House. So I think that, you know, it's probably worth mentioning that, sure, Democrats are the opposition party here, but you do have a government and a White House and a Congress that, you know, that are run by Republicans. And it's, so what we're seeing is, you know, a very intriguing set of circumstance that, you know, the government broadly is not functioning well with one party in power.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call. Chris on Facebook writes, can you explain how this affects those of us out here in the hinterland who might, for instance, have a federal complaint in the pipeline attached to a lawsuit?
Well, I don't really know the nature of your complaint. You know, in general, yeah, it's hard for me to say, address that, because I don't know the nature of it. But I would say to the caller or emailer that, you know, most day-to-day functions of government are continuing, and as they should be. And that's why we have a civil service, because though there are 2 million civil servants and they are sprinkled around, you know, around the country, around every agency, and they're job is to be apolitical, and so they really run the functions of government day to day. Now, there are some, I mean, we've heard reports that there are some programs, some offices in the government whose missions are very much at odds with what the Trump administration wants
yes.
to focus on, and that in some of those areas, for example, fair housing complaints would be one example. You know, things are not moving at a really, really quick pace. But I don't know what the caller's or emailer's you know, complaint is, so I can't really address it.
And let's look at the EPA for a moment. So you're saying that you have a number of people who are civil servants now because it's not up to full staff here with the way the administration wants it to be, who might be, some of them, opposed to the current philosophy of the EPA?
No, what I'm saying is that civil servants, by definition, who are the career employees at agencies,
right.
they're non-political. And so they have jobs to do. And, you know, to change the course of, let's say, you know, enforcement of the Clean Air Act, let's say, which is one of the main tasks of the EPA, well, that has to be changed legislatively. And, you know, some regulations take months and months, if not years, to roll back, and those regulations. These are environmental regulations that Trump has vowed to roll back. But those regulations and those rollbacks are going to be caught up in the court system. And so in the meantime, the law is the law, and civil servants have to carry out the law. So, for example, at the Labor Department, you know, there are inspections for mine safety. You know, the occupational health and health enforcement is going on. You know, workplace enforcement of wage and hour laws is continuing. I mean, the government has not ground to a halt because by law it can't. Right. That's my point.
And so here's where I'm confused. So you have a number of career, I'm just wondering how many there are, career employees who really are not political in the jobs they're doing. They're helping to keep the government running, and it doesn't matter who's in office.
Right. So there are 2 million career civil servants, and the largest chunk of those are at the Defense Department, and they comprise 750,000 people. That's an amazing amount of people. Yeah. And they get direction from political appointees, and that's how every you know, political administration is. Mm-hmm. A new White House comes in, new president, and, you know, they can appoint, I think it's up to 4,000 people. But, though, you know, many of those are lower level, and, you know, some are entry level jobs. You know, so those, some of those political appointees would never have, you know, a lot of authority anyway. But my point is that, you know, policies don't change overnight, because some of them are protected by laws.
I see. Carlene in Brooklyn. Hi, Carlene.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a comment, and I'll say right up front, I did not vote for Donald Trump. I find him terrifying. And the fact that some of his appointments have not been confirmed is kind of okay with me, because I find them terrifying. And that so many slots are left open is also, I mean, it's just an incredibly frightening time, and I'm not sure what there is to say about that, except that it's very anxiety-producing.
Lisa.
All right. Right. Well, I think, you know, a lot of liberals, and there are many of them in this country, feel that way. But I think that, you know, for voters who did vote for the president, they, you know, they really want to see change. They want to see changes to regulations that, you know, small businesses, large businesses feel are really hampering them. You know, the environmental community, of course, is very frustrated by what Trump is proposing. But, you know, on the other side, you know, again, you've just got conservatives who feel very differently about that. And it is funny, because Trump himself has actually said, agrees with Max Steyer, you know, Trump has said, you know, I think we have too many political appointees. I'm not sure that we really need to fill all these jobs. And there's just, I think, a question looming out there. Trump has said he really wants to reduce the size of government.
Right.
And every president, believe it or not, in modern history has said the same thing. It's just a matter of degrees. And so he has submitted a budget to Congress that would drastically reduce the size of government and of many budgets. The State Department budget would take a 30% hit. EPA would take a very similar hit. You know, Congress is going to restore a lot of that money. And so that'll be sort of the next thing we'll wait to see. But I do think that, you know, conservatives have a very good point. There is a lot of waste in government. There is a lot of inefficiency in government. I think, though, that liberals would argue, well, you just have to be careful the way you try to cut programs, because when you do it ideologically, when it's driven by ideology, that's where you can get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree, Carlene? I don't know if you're there still. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Do you think there's waste in government?
Certainly there are places where there's waste in government, but the EPA, for instance, is one of those agencies that is doing incredibly important work. Or NOAA, mm-hmm. the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the budget there has been slashed in ways that are dangerous or wants to be slashed. And these are the people that predict hurricanes and tell us all kinds of things that are likely to happen. They save lives And so those kinds of things are absolutely terrifying to me.
Right. So, Carly, it's just the whole budget, these budget cuts are, if they were to be enacted, they would be really draconian. But I think everyone in Washington agrees that they are a starting point, and that Congress, I mean, including Republicans, who are getting pushback from their constituents, the budget that ultimately passes is not going to look a whole lot like what Trump has proposed, you know, if that's any consolation to you. But yes, there is a definite philosophy at work that... What can I say? You know, he was elected president. A lot of his voters feel strongly about, you know, the government being smaller. But I guess I would say it is really hard to cut the size of government. It's very hard to do, to do it right, and to actually cut where there is duplication and there is waste, and where there's inefficiency. In part because it's very hard to identify that inefficiency in such a large budget, and it's a challenge for every president.
Thank you, Carlene, so much for your call. Lisa Ryan is our guest. She's a reporter for The Washington Post. She covers the federal workforce and issues that relate to the management of government. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Back with you in a moment on the Ideas Network. I want to find out how much of this is going on. You outlined the problems that all of the cabinet secretaries are facing in terms of not having enough people in their departments. I want to know if there's a lot of political pushback happening here. You, in an article, talk about Rex Tillerson, who picked a pretty respected, I know this guy, he's been around for a long time, veteran of Reagan and George W. Bush administration, Elliot Abrams, to be his deputy secretary. Abrams met with Jared Kushner. And evidently, Trump told Bannon, Bannon had vetoed the choice because Abrams had been critical of Trump during the election campaign. Is there a lot of that going on?
Right. So with Mr. Abrams, and I did speak to him, I can't remember actually if he signed a Never Trump letter. You know, there were many people in the foreign policy establishment during the campaign who we call them the Never Trumpers, but, you know, who signed this letter saying we don't feel that Mr. Trump is qualified to be president and to, you know, sort of handle foreign policy issues. I can't remember if Abrams had signed that letter or in some other way criticized Trump, but it is definitely true that that there is sort of this vetting for loyalty, and again, to some degree, this happens with every White House. But because we're in a social media age, as we all know, you know, stuff that you might have said on Twitter or Facebook is very easily traced, and it can go viral. And so, with each of these nominees, they are closely looking for anything that they might have said that was negative about the president when he was running. And that has definitely felled a number of people.
Well, a lot of people said negative things about this guy. I mean, this president, a lot of people did. Right?
Right. So, you know, it's sort of one of the pitfalls, I think, of having a president who, you know, very proudly calls himself a disruptor, you know, in a White House who says it wants people who want real change and not just former government bureaucrats, you know, it wants people from the private sector, you know, to bring real change. But that does get complicated because you have to find, you know, the if you're going to eliminate, you know, sort of people who worked in the Bush administration,
right,
people who worked in the Obama administration, people who said something negative about the president because they were, when he was running for office, because they were concerned that, you know, his personality was maybe a little bit, you know, too alternative, too not mainstream enough. So we have heard that, but I, you know, I don't really have specific evidence, but we've just heard that in some cases it's been hard for people to find people to step up. They're reluctant to serve in the administration, especially because, you know, if they're lobbyists or have had lobbying experience or want to cash out on their government experience. So Trump put this rule in place that once you leave the government, you can't lobby the government for 5 years. That's a very, very strict rule that is off-putting to some people as well.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of people who are on the phone lines, and I'm so sorry, everybody, but we just have run out of time. So all I can do is say, please go to our Facebook page. We'll be delighted to read your comments, and I know that that will make you feel better if you can go and do that, because otherwise we won't be able to hear your thoughts today. But we'll hear them at another time. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us and for all of your great reporting on this. It's something that we overlook and we shouldn't.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. Lisa Rhine, reporter at the Washington Post, talking about all the positions that have not been filled. And there are many of them that have not been filled and why that is the case. Cabinet secretaries, she begins one article, are growing exasperated how slowly the White House is moving to fill hundreds of top-tier positions. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this program, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in Milwaukee. And thank you for your calls. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll be with you again mañana a las uno. Hope you'll listen.